Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I suppose I should say welcome to the Delicious Legacy podcast. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
To the listeners, you are Mimi A, and you are the author of Mandalay. Tell us a little bit about the book, introduce yourself so my listeners can know a little bit more about you.
Okay, so about me first. So I was born in the UK, but I'm Burmese and my family are all Burmese. So they came here just before I was born. My parents, as I said to you earlier, have always thought that they would go back to Burma at some point. And I use the word Burma just because I'm old, although the country was officially renamed to Myanmar. It was actually renamed by a military junta, which is one of the reasons we rejected the name. They wanted to make sure that I didn't forget my roots, you know, my delicious legacy, let's say. I ate Burmese food at home. I spoke Burmese. I was brought up with Burmese traditions and culture. Because I think my mum and dad thought that they were equipping us for the future. Because they thought, at some point we'll go back. And, you know, my brothers, they were 9 and 6 when we came here. So they were already, they already spoke Burmese. And so it wasn't a problem for them. But for me, I was learning from scratch, right? we were kind of brought up with the tradition of food and Burmese food and culture. And then I kind of got into kind of food writing probably about 10 years ago, maybe a little over 10 years ago when I had a blog. I did that thing where everybody just kind of writes about what food they like. And then I started writing more about Burmese food specifically. I got a book deal kind of off the back of that in 2013. And that book was a book about noodles, which was imaginatively just called Noodle. It wasn't my choice. It was part of a series, so all the rest of the books are called Soup and Stew, so it's not my fault. But when I got that book, I kind of thought to myself, oh, actually, I can, because a lot of the recipes I have are word of mouth recipes or ones that I'd kind of learnt from observing, right? So none of them had ever been written down. There was, at the time, very little on the internet, very little kind of written texts in Burmese or in English. Lots of these recipes were very much ones that only existed in people's minds. And, you know, I wanted to use the opportunity, because obviously I never even thought I'd get one book, let alone two. So I wanted to use the opportunity to kind of put a lot of my heritage recipes into this book about noodles. And so I think about 8 or 9 of them are all Burmese recipes. And one thing I kind of really need to point out is that Burmese is like the kind of catch-all term for the food from Burma, because there are lots of, there's over 130 ethnic groups. And I myself, I'm a big mix of ethnicities. I'm part Shan, I'm part Indha, I'm part Burman, I'm part Yunnanese. So there's like this random Chinese part of me that I don't know much about. It's very complicated. but it meant that the recipes that I put in that first book were kind of, even though nominally Burmese, it was lots of different ones. So there's one from Yakine, Arakan State. There's a couple from Shan State. There are a couple from the kind of mainland. And I thought, okay, this is really nice because I'm getting to pass on these recipes, document these recipes that don't really exist in any form anywhere else yet.
Mm. Yeah.
It was really nice. And then I kind of just chugged away, like, trying to teach people about Burmese food and on social media primarily, but also on my blog. And then I don't know what it was. I just zeitgeist, who knows. I finally ended up getting a deal for a book just about Burmese food. And so, you know, Mandalay Recipes and Tales from a Burmese Kitchen came out in 2019.
Yes, with a lot of critical acclaim, I must add.
Thank you. Yes, I mean, it's a weird kind of thing because I have a very strange relationship with my book because it's sort of a memoir in a weird kind of way. I had very understanding publishers who kind of allowed me to do whatever I wanted.
Yeah.
And so I think slightly distinct from a lot of other books out there and definitely different from the books that already exist on Burmese food, I've put in probably, like, the introduction is like over 40 pages. And it's talking about my family history. It's also talking about culture. It's talking about, you know, geographical things that people might not be aware of. So, yeah, that was something that I was really, really delighted to be able to do. And also, like, even the recipes, I tried to put all of the recipes into context. Mm. So I tried really hard not to just say, this is a tasty dish, but explain, you know, where the dish came from, why it was important to me. But because of this, because of all of that, it's a very, very personal book in a lot of ways. And so I was really frightened when it was published because I thought if people didn't like it, that was like a personal judgment of me, you know. You know what I mean?
Totally. It makes sense.
So as you say, when it came out, it did have a lot of critical acclaim, which I was really kind of taken aback by. And, like, you know, it made me cry a bit because it's kind of one of those things where you think, oh, God, people really do like this. So, you know, it was on the best book of the year list for the, what was it, for The Observer, for the Financial Times and The Mail on Sunday. So quite a wide range.
Very wide range indeed, yes. In this country, at least, we don't know much about Burma and about Burmese food, to be honest. We are more acquired with the Indian food and Thai food, and obviously more Southeast Asia, like Vietnamese food. But I don't think Burmese is so well known here. Is it because there's not much community and diaspora
here? So the diaspora here is unusual. It's less so now. So, and probably for the last, until about 5 years ago, there was only one Burmese restaurant in the whole of the country. And that had been around since the 90s. And that was a restaurant that had actually come over from Norway. So it had originally been set up by a Burmese family in Norway, who then came over to London. But other than that, the diaspora was very, very specifically a brain drain from Burma in the 60s and 70s. And what it was it's mainly doctors and nurses, mainly doctors, to be fair.
Yeah.
And so they were people who came over to the UK, usually because they had been appointed to a role in the NHS here. So they had a vocation, which meant that their main thing was kind of saving lives and looking after people, right?
Yeah.
And so food was, although incredibly important, it was always secondary. It was always a hobby. There was never any question that anyone would set up a restaurant. You know, it just wasn't a thing because people were here for a specific reason and a specific job. Now,
yeah.
You know, after that, it's been very hard coming over to Burma because there are lots and lots of roadblocks put by the military government, which meant that it was very difficult for even like my family to visit us. It was just pretty much impossible. But in the past, I don't know, maybe 10 years or so, it's been, the people have been able to come over. And I think this is partly because there was, let's say, a notional democracy in Burma, although no one really ever believed it. But it was open enough because they wanted people to come over. They wanted tourists to come over. Yeah. But they also wanted, so it also meant that people could come over to the rest of the world. So we had entrepreneurs, we had foodies, we had business people come over, people in hospitality come from Burma wanting to, you know, spread the love for Burmese food. So yeah. We suddenly started seeing restaurants open up. So there's one in Shoreditch called La Pette, which started off as like a pop-up underneath the bridge or something, I think it was. but they're wonderful. Actually, the head chef is from the same part of Burma as my mum. So his tastes are very similar to mine. They're very aligned with mine.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there are a couple of other places that have been popping up. And there are actually also places, and I think it's a bit like the whole kind of Indian restaurants actually being run by Bangladeshis type thing.
Yeah.
But there are a few Thai restaurants that kind of turned into Burmese restaurants in the last few years.
Interesting.
So it's kind of a thing where actually they were Burmese all along but didn't think that people would want to eat Burmese food.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Because I guess people didn't know about it, didn't know about the country as well itself much.
And that's because, you know, the government had kept it so in the darkness, had hidden it from the rest of the world.
Isolated,
Very much a policy of economic isolation.
Exactly.
And so, yeah. And then, of course, people boycotted going there for such a long time because of the military government. So, you know, no one was coming back or forth.
So in a few words, in Phukan, how would you describe Burmese food?
So I keep changing how I describe Burmese food, helpfully. Mm. But I've decided actually one of the best ways to describe it is, I think it's probably most similar to Malaysian food, I've been saying.
I see.
And the reason I say this, although we only really eat coconuts in desserts, but the reason I say this is because I think Malaysian food has the kind of, I don't know what the term is, it's as capricious and whimsical as Burmese food insofar as you can't define it by one type of food. So we like curries, but we like noodles and we like salads and we like fritters. So, you know, basically whatever kind of dish you want to eat, you can go and eat it.
Yeah.
So you can't, you know, you can't write it off. And also in terms of flavors as well. So we don't really, apart from the fact that every dish has to have, let's say, two or three different flavors.
Yeah.
You can't really pinpoint what those flavors might be. Mm. So it's one of the things that Burmese people complain about is kind of boredom or monotony in a dish. And this is about flavor, but it's also about texture. So you know congee. You know how congee is beloved in almost every country in Asia. Burmese people don't like it generally. And the reason we don't like it is because it's dull.
Right.
It's considered something that you give to invalids or to people who are trying to lose weight. It is. It's kind of like gruel, basically, because it's like, oh my God, you know, what is this thing? And it doesn't matter how many different garnishes or stuff you put on it, it's still just considered bleh. And so, like, in terms of like our soups as well, so we have things that we call soups, but they're not blended up. You know, you've got chunks of things, and you've got crispy onions on top, and you've got this, that, and the other. So like, there's interest in every spoonful or every chopstickful, and every kind of mouthful you have is different. It's formulated differently. So yeah, I think that's probably the easiest way to describe it.
I think definitely that's obviously rice is one of the principal staple thing.
It is.
Yeah.
Rice, we have this thing where, like in a lot of countries, instead of saying, have you eaten yet? We say, have you had your rice yet? So we do love rice, but it's kind of considered the daily meal.
Yeah.
But we like to have things with it. So you know, you will have your bowl of rice on a table, but you'll also have soup on the side, and you'll also have like crudités, and you'll also have two types of curry, and you'd also have a stir fry, and you'd also have kind of like fritters, and you'd also have a salad.
Yeah.
So like, you need to be able to turn the rice, which it's still the star. The rice is still the star, but it combines with other things to make something really special.
Yeah, fantastic. And in terms of, so basically you said you're using chopsticks like most of the Southeastern Asian countries. Well,
we don't actually. just to be confusing. So we actually have a tradition of eating with our hands. Mm. So we're actually more similar to like say India in that way. We only really use chopsticks for noodle dishes that we've adapted or have been inspired by China.
Yeah.
So we have noodle dishes that we eat with a spoon or with our hands as well. So.
Oh right. Okay. Yeah.
So like the thing, one of the things that kind of breaks my mind whenever I see it is our national dish is a dish called mohinga, which is kind of like a fish noodle soup. Mm-hmm. So we call it a soup, but it's got a lot of texture in it. So there are noodles and there is fish cake and, you know, there are fritters and all those sort of things in it. But it absolutely, absolutely has to be eaten with a spoon.
Yeah.
To the extent that there is a specific type of spoon, which is, you know, like it's like a Chinese soup spoon, but it's metal.
Yeah.
So I think Thai people use it a lot as well. So we call that spoon a mohinga spoon because it's so important that you use this spoon. And then, so when I see people in diaspora, mainly restaurants in the diaspora, and they are just catering to their audience, and so I understand, but I see them dishing stuff up using chopsticks, dishing our national dish up using chopsticks, and it makes me want to cry because in my brain, it's like if someone set up a fish and chip shop and served the fish and chips with the chopsticks, you know?
Yeah.
because that's not how we eat it. You
know? Yeah, of course, it makes sense. I do like the sound of your soups, actually. I think that's how soups should be, to be honest, with some chunks, something crunchy though. Yeah, it just reminds me.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. That sounds the best kind of soup. And so obviously rice is very important. Also, rice cultivation kind of start from Southeast Asia and China. And it's been for, you know, I don't know, 6,000 years, really, down there. But also tea is very important in Burmese cuisine, isn't it?
Yes, it is. In a way that I'm not sure it is in anywhere else because we eat tea.
yes, that's your unique point, actually.
Yes, so, you know, our possibly our most famous thing that we have is something called lapel, which is pickled tea leaves. Pickled tea leaves are kind of historically important as well as culturally important because Burma's always been a mess. It's always been warring kingdoms because of the different ethnic groups. And what would happen historically is if a kingdom kind of decided to make peace with another kingdom, in the same way that, you know, you might have a peace pipe, the kings would sit down together and eat lapet.
Right. Okay.
And you have it, so like we have this rite of passage for Buddhists, you have this rite of passage called Shenbyu, and Shenbyu is when a boy becomes a man. It's like a bar mitzvah, but they have to kind of go into a monastery and kind of be a novice monk for like a week or two. And what they do before that is they have this big ceremony where they dress up as a prince, and they get treated like a prince, and there's a big celebration, and this kind of is meant to mimic what happened to Siddhartha Gautama, who was the Buddha.
Yeah,
because what he was a prince, and then he decided to become the Buddha because he was upset by all of the horror that he saw around him, and so he couldn't face being a prince anymore. And so what this is, you know, you dress your child like a king, and then he becomes a monk. But for this ceremony, it's such a big thing, it's such an important thing, like family and friends are invited. And to invite people to that ceremony, what you do traditionally is you go around to your neighbors and you offer them some lapet to say you're invited to this ceremony. If people come around to your house, they just drop by. In the same way that you might give people tea and biscuits in the UK, in Burma, you give them two types of tea because you give them green tea to drink and you give them this pickled tea to eat. So yeah, it's a huge cultural thing that we're really proud of. And yeah.
How do you make it, first of all, and how does it taste like?
Okay, so making it, it's one of those things that you would never ever make it yourself. It's like miso. You basically, they get huge silos of these tea leaves, and it's fermented and it's pressed in the sun, and I think it's left for 8 weeks, and then it's either pounded or mixed with various seasonings. Mm. But it's not something that anyone would ever attempt to make at home, although I am trying because it's hard to get it in this country.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's something that you go and buy in a stall, in a shop, in a supermarket. And the way it tastes, so texturally, it's like tea leaves. It's like after you've had some tea and they're left with fresh tea leaves. But the taste is... I like to compare it most, and I actually use this as a common substitute, baby artichokes. Because it's astringent, it's a little bit sour, it's a little bit bitter, but and it's a little bit savory. So it's got all these kind of different flavors coming through. But the way it's really special is you don't generally tend to eat it by itself. You eat it with various accompaniments. So like crunchy things normally. So the way they have it in Mandalay, which is where my family are from, but most of my family are from Mandalay or Upper Burma anyway. Mm-hmm. You have something that's called aloo lepet, and aloo kind of means celebration offering. And this type of lepet is served up in this really beautiful lacquer dish generally, which has kind of divisions, and each compartment has a different type of garnish in it. So you've got lepet in the middle, the pickled tea in the middle. And then around the edges, you have things like fried broad beans and sesame seeds fried garlic and dried shrimp and all these kind of little nutty little bits all around it. And the way you're meant to eat it is you use a teaspoon and you kind of create a little parcel for yourself and then you eat it. So that's the Mandalay way. And the Yangon way is kind of known as lepet dau, which means lepet salad. And so what they do is they get pretty much the same ingredients, but then they add fresh tomatoes and sometimes fresh white cabbage. And then it's mixed together with a bit more of a dressing. So a squeeze of lime and a squeeze more of oil. And that's lepet salad. Mm. So yeah, those are the kind of two major ways of eating lepet.
Sounds delicious.
It's really nice. But like I said, if you can't get hold of it, baby artichokes work very well.
Very interesting. Yeah, that's something very unique and very different from other cuisines and things that you had of the area. So really intrigued me, really kind of made me curious to see how you make it and, you know, how does it taste like. It's not very often that you find things that are very unique and you haven't had them before. So there's always some similarities you can compare to something else. Obviously, we all love eating and we love having feasts and extravagant stuff. So there's always, from one place to the next, you can connect dots, but there's something that you never had before. It's like, oh my God, that's great stuff. That's great stuff. What are your, I don't know, I think I would say your favorite traditional dishes?
My favorite dishes? It varies. I think probably the one
top three, maybe?
Top three, let's say. Okay. So I think my favorite dish is probably one called Mogo Miche, which is a dish from Mogo, which is where my mum's from and where that chef from Lepet is from, the restaurant Lepet. And what that is it's rice noodles and topped with pork, usually pork shoulder or pork belly.
Yeah.
And then it's got kind of like a tamarind dressing and garlic and coriander and crispy onions. And it's one of those, it's like hot, spicy and sour noodles, basically. And so it's really refreshing. And like, even if you've got a massive bowl, you don't feel like you've eaten too much because of the sour, the spice. And I love that just because it is so delicious. But I also love it because I associate it with coming home.
Yeah.
And when I say going home, I mean going to Burma because, you know, whenever we land from the airport and we get whisked by car to my auntie's house. And that's always the dish that's on the table, always. So it's the first thing I eat as soon as I've stepped on Burmese soil. So yeah, that's probably why that's my favourite. And then my second favourite is hilariously probably the Mandalay version of the same dish. And the reason that is because, you know, Mandalay's where my dad's family are from. So it's kind of very much a family thing. So Mogok's my mom's family, Mandalay's my dad's family. But the reason Mandalay Miche is probably my second favorite dish is it's one I associate with parties. Because in this country, whenever friends and family came around, my mum would break it out because it was such a crowd pleaser. It's the same base of rice noodles, but my mum would normally use spaghetti because it was one of the ones she first cooked in this country and you couldn't get rice noodles at the time. So there'd be the spaghetti base, and then she'd use chicken rather than pork because chicken in Burma, ironically, chicken is really expensive and beef is cheap because no one really eats beef. So to use chicken showed you were well off. So basically chicken would be the meat, the preferred meat. And that showed fantastic. That she was being generous and, you know, being really, and it was also the first dish my mum used to let me help make, but the job she gave me was totally pointless. I realized in the retrospect, because what she asked me to do, this is like when I was like 5 years old, I think 4 or 5, she'd give me a bowl of, soybeans, so kind of fermented yellow beans, I think this is. So not the black beans, but kind of like the slightly kind of more liquid yellow beans. And what she would do is she'd give me that and she'd give me a spoon, like a really kind of flat-based spoon, and she'd ask me to squish them to make a smooth sauce. Now, the reason obviously this is pointless is, A, you don't need to do that because we like the texture anyway, and B, you can also buy the yellow bean paste ready-made.
Of course.
But I think it was to make me feel useful. So I have this association with it being that this is the sauce that I used to make, the first dish I used to help cook, but also it's to do with parties. And then my third favorite dish, again, it's a chicken-based dish, and it's always referred to as like our version of biryani. It's called dumbao. But I wouldn't say it was biryani. I think it's much more like the original Iranian dish, not least because dumbao kind of is derived from the term dumpukt, which I think is an Iranian term. And what this is it's like a rice pilaf with chicken and with kind of various herbs and, you know, spices. But it's considered like the most celebratory of dishes. Nice. So it's the one that's served at weddings. And we actually served it at my wedding. So it's very much a dish where it's kind of, and it's expensive because you've got all these expensive herbs, you've got saffron in it, and you know what I mean? So it's the dish that we always serve when something really, really special is happening. So some kind of massive celebration. Those are my three dishes. So Mogok Miche because of my mum, Mandalay Miche because of my dad, and biryani because of my wedding. So dumbao.
Brilliant. Do you know, or can you enlighten us a little bit about the connection with Iran? What's the connection with Iran?
Just the fact that there was kind of people, immigrants from Iran, I believe. Even relatively recently. So my mum's uncle, my mum's auntie is married to, they always refer to him as a Persian mullah. We've got, you know, Iranians in our own family. So I think there's always been some kind of movement back and forth. There's another dish which I particularly like, which again, I believe has Iranian roots. And it's again, a chicken dish, but it's a curry and it's a cinnamon curry. And we don't use cinnamon in that many other dishes, but this is like a really, really lovely, fragrant, curry. And it's a big crowd pleaser, this one. I made it once when I did a takeover. I took over a friend's restaurant for the night, and it was one of the dishes on the menu that night, the cinnamon chicken. And one of the guests was a farmer, a cattle farmer. And so this was out in Dorset, so that's why. And the cattle farmer passed on a message to me in the kitchen and said, if I gave him the recipe for my cinnamon chicken, he would give up beef forever.
So, I think that's a great compliment.
I know.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Yeah, so obviously the importance of festivals and communal eating is quite big.
It's very big. Burma. I mean, weirdly enough, we don't necessarily have specific foods tied to festivals. So we have that one. And then our New Year is in April. It's called Dajan or Dinjan is another way of saying it. And we have one dessert associated with that, which is called Molong Yebo, which is like, it's basically it's a bit like mochi again. So, you know, as mentioned before about the Japanese dish. So it's like, and again, it's a rice cake, but inside you have like a piece of sugar, a piece of palm sugar. And again, it's a communal activity. What happens is that you all take turns rolling it. So you all kind of, you sit around in a big group and you have this big basket of dough in the middle of rice dough, it is. And so you're making these little kind of balls and then you're all taking turns to put in the lump of sugar and roll it up again. And then you throw it into a basket and then someone takes the basket and then they kind of poach them, I guess, in water. And then it rises up and then it's cooked. And the reason it's called Molong Yebo is it means kind of round snack floating on the water. It's a very literal name. But the thing I like about this is it's kind of associated with the kind of the playfulness of our festival, because it's at the same time as like the Thai water festival Songkran, and it is a water festival, so it's mainly mischief, so it's people kind of chucking water at each other and getting into all sorts of pranks and japes, and there's a prank that's associated with this dessert, this New Year dessert, where basically you're meant to be putting the sugar in, but like every 10th ball or so you put a bird's eye chili in. And then it's like Russian roulette. No one knows which one's got the chili in it. And they're all being boiled up together. And so, like, it gets served. So what happens is that you get, like, three or four on a palm leaf and it's sprinkled with a little bit of coconut, grated coconut. And you take your bite and you're meant to eat it in one. And so you get intense pleasure or intense pain, basically. So, and they go, Happy New Year!
It sounds great. It sounds great. Yeah, oh, you make me hungry, Phil. That's a problem. Sorry. Now. I want to eat all these dishes. Anyway, that's going to happen at some point in life.
It will. But the thing actually that I wanted to point out is that although these festivals, they are all kind of notionally Buddhist festivals, the way Burma works is, I guess it's a bit like everyone celebrates Christmas. So we have these festivals, but everyone pretty much joins in, which is really nice. So like New Year, although that is technically the Buddhist New Year, it's a national holiday, you know.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everyone's partying, everyone's having fun, it doesn't matter what religion they are. Because the country is so predominantly, in the same way the UK is predominantly a Christian country, Burma is predominantly Buddhist. And so the national holidays are generally Buddhist ones. Although, unlike the UK, for example, we recognise Eid, that's also a national holiday. But because of that, it's associated with people having time off and people having fun. So it means that everyone joins in, which means it's more of a cultural thing rather than a religious thing. So I kind of forget that it's a Buddhist thing at all. And I'm a terrible Buddhist. In the same way that I think many ostensibly Christian people know nothing about Christianity, I know nothing about Buddhism.
Fair enough.
I just remember it's New Year, so...
Yes, New Year's, yeah. Celebrate. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It's not. I suppose, is that why you don't have so much beef, or because why the beef is so cheap? Because it's mainly a Buddhist country.
Sort of. So I think that's more of a Burmese thing. So basically in Burma, like even until recently, farming was generally done in very old-fashioned manual ways. So instead of tractors, you would have like buffaloes and cows doing all the work. Yeah. And so what happened was that these animals kind of became part of the family. And as a result, we didn't really do dairy farming either. So milk wasn't really available, or generally dairy generally wasn't consumed in Burma, apart from kind of like condensed milk and evaporated milk. So that kind of horrific thing. It's funny actually. There is so we really like milky tea. We've always really loved milky tea. So the two types of tea we have is green tea, which we call yinuijiang, and milky tea, which is called lepeye. And there's kind of there's sort of nuances with lepeye. So you can say things like there's various terms which I can't remember for the life of me right now. But there are ways of saying a little bit less sugar, a little bit more sugar, or a little bit milk in there. But until relatively recently, the milkiness was achieved by, you know, like milk powder. Kind of process. And we liked it so much that we, you know, we're very famous for this stuff called 3-in-1, which is basically tea and milk and sugar in a packet, all mixed up. So you can't change the strengths of anything at all. And the same with coffee. Coffee was also had in the same 3-in-1 style. So you'd have a packet of milk tea and a packet of coffee. And you know, if you like black tea, if you like cappuccino, if you like espresso, you're screwed because none of that exists.
I love all these small, unique things that countries have. It's brilliant. So I guess, as you're saying, you didn't have, as a country, traditionally, they didn't consume milk or dairy products.
No, not really,
much.
No. Yeah. I mean, oil, a lot of oil. Oil is like sacred almost in Burma. In the same way that, you know how like you might insult someone by saying that their cake was a bit dry? In Burma, if you say something lacks oil, that's also a big insult.
Fantastic. I love oil. As a Mediterranean,
of course.
Use olive oil
all
the time on everything. It's I think I consume too much oil, but I understand the insult bit. I think it speaks to my heart. So beef it wasn't obviously consumed, but chicken was more the most expensive thing, the most celebrated, and pig.
Oh, well,
pork was,
I mean, that's our staple.
Normal.
Yeah. Pork is our staple. To the extent that I mentioned this in my book, but like if in Moga, which is where my mum's from, it's like the most favourite meat ever, to the extent that, you know, my uncle would go out and instead of saying that he was going to go and earn some money, he'd said he'd go out and get the pork funds.
So, like, who's bringing home the bacon?
Yes, exactly like that.
Brilliant. In terms of sauces, sauce-based stuff, do you have anything particularly unique from Burma?
Yeah, so we have this thing called bonyeji, which is primarily from this place called Nyangshui Bagan. So Bagan is basically one of the historical capitals of Burma. It's the one that is like our equivalent of Angkor Wat. It's just full of ancient temples. So just outside that is the area of Nyangshui, and basically they produce this sauce, which is like a very rich fermented sauce. I guess it's a bit like miso, and it's made from, it's called the horse gram bean, and it's very hard to describe. It's very pungent, but in a really kind of Moorish way. It's not unpleasant, but it's very strongly smelling. And it's very savory and it's very salty and it's a little bit sour. And it's unique. I don't think I've tried anything that tastes exactly like it. And the way we eat that is we either eat it in a salad with onions. So it's basically kind of onions and maybe a little of some other vegetables dressed with this sauce, this bongyeji sauce. Or we make a pork curry with it, which is bongyeji weta. And again, it's something that it's actually so regional that probably maybe 20 years ago, you couldn't get it anywhere apart from in the area.
Right.
But now you can get like instant mixes, just add water type thing, which is kind of like dehydrated bongyeji, because I don't think it keeps particularly well as a kind of made up sauce. But you can get packets, which I even have some in my fridge, I think, where, you know, you can just make this sauce. So that is, I actually have a recipe. I learned how to make that myself, because I'm an idiot. And I think I even said in the recipe, this is going to take forever. So, you know, make it because it is so iconic and unique, but it's very tiring. So, yeah, it's a big disclaimer at the start of the recipe.
Yeah.
I think I referred to it as black gold because it is, yeah, it's such a beautiful dark color. And yeah. It's really nice. Wow.
Can you find it in UK in Oriental markets, supermarkets?
Not normal ones. You can. There's a few Burmese suppliers, but like I said, it's very scarce. Otherwise,
it's very difficult. But
you can make it. It will take you a week. And you'll go mad. But you can make it.
I'm already mad. That's fine. That's fine. Great. I love it. So obviously, in Chinese culture, a lot of the food has medical properties, and obviously in ancient Europe and ancient Greece and old medieval Europe, the food was associated with hot and cold and all these properties. Is there anything similar in Burmese cuisine or Burmese food?
We do have that, but that wasn't passed on so much by my family, just because I have so many doctors in my family that they all poo-pooed it a little bit. Mm. So it was not something that we ever believed in particularly.
Yeah.
There's the odd kind of superstition that was passed on. Like, for example, there's a strong belief that bitter foods are good for you. No rhyme or reason behind it, but it meant that a very popular vegetable is bitter melon. It's called Corella, I think, in this country. It's a very spiky looking gourd, which is just incredibly bitter, and it's my mum's favorite vegetable, and
really?
It's the favorite, yeah, and it's like an iconic vegetable in Burma, and I can't stand it. I mean, I think probably as I've got older, I've been able to tolerate it a bit more and almost like it. But it's one of those things where you're told you have to eat it because not only is it delicious, it's incredibly good for you. And then there's another similar leaf called Dama in Burmese, but in Indian English it's called neem, and similarly it's a very, very bitter leaf, and weirdly I quite like that one. I don't know why, but again, it's one of those things where we're told it's good for your health without any kind of explanation as to why it's good for your health, apart from it's punishing you. So
yeah, maybe that's why. Anything that punishes you is good for you, I suppose. Maybe it has to do with poverty and peasants and people that, you know, when you don't have plenty of stuff and that's what's left to eat,
well,
you have to.
It's funny because I was always told my grandmother on my dad's side was really into herbal medicines. She used to spend all her time just making like homemade herbal pills basically,
right?
And she had like a rack of bottles on her kitchen cabinet, which just looked terrifying to me. I remember kind of like playing in the kitchen and just staring at them thinking, this all looks really, really weird. And none of it was labeled, obviously. So but one of the things she did, this is probably, oh god, it must be about 30 years ago, she tried to make my mum has asthma, and she tried to make my mum take turmeric and honey pills. And so my mum was like, what the hell is this? Because my mum, you know, my mum's a doctor, my dad's a doctor. And at the time they were like, what is this nonsense? And my grandmother was like, no, you should do it. And of course it turns out that combination is actually good for asthma, like medically found to be good. So my grandmother wasn't talking rubbish. And it means my mum, now in her old age, she makes these pills herself now. And then if you go into like Holland and Barrett or anything, you can get turmeric pills now. And my mum saw how expensive they were, and she was like, never mind, I'll make my own.
Yeah.
Just like your grandmother.
I thought you could.
But again, I think But again, it's the thing about the bitterness, because obviously turmeric's quite a bitter, bitter spice.
Yeah, on its own, it's very bitter and pungent. Yeah, of course.
It's kind of funny because obviously there is a lot of tradition about what goes with what food. And one of the funniest things that has come out in terms of tourism is there's been this poster that's been circulating, which originated from Chinatown in Yangon, which was the capital city. And basically it's like a trilingual poster. It's got Chinese and English and Burmese written on it. And it has the foods that will cause you different ailments depending on the combination you eat them in. But it's utter nonsense. So it's got this, there's one whole column which says that, no, seriously, it's got one whole column that says if you eat these two foods together, you will die. And then there's another one which says if you eat these two foods together, you will get diarrhea. And then there's another one which says that you will, you know, if you eat these two together, you will become faint. So it's just complete hokum. Yeah. It's nonsense. But my favourite, in the you will die section, it's got some very bizarre combinations. And when I say bizarre, I mean normal combinations that I have eaten and I know it won't kill me. So it's got things like, I can't remember the top of my head, but it's something like if you eat melon and honey together, you will die. And so I'm like, where the hell has this come from? It makes no sense.
And especially, yeah, fruit and honey, which is nice and healthy. I suppose maybe they mean that you're going to die of old age in a...
maybe. 70
years.
but it's funny because of that we have our superstitions, but I don't think we have ones that we take that seriously, to be honest. And like the other thing that I find quite interesting and distinct from a lot of countries in the part where we are, Southeast Asia, is that we don't have any real kind of taboos to do with pregnancy either. So you know how like in China and a lot of the kind of like other countries in the area, they have this thing where after you've given birth you have to eat specific foods to get your strength up, and you have to like stay at home for a month and all that kind of stuff. We don't have anything like that. I think there might be a little bit of that like out in the country, like in the really rural places, but it's not like a normal thing to do. Whereas, so when I've seen other, you know, friends of mine from other countries do that kind of thing, and they go, "Oh, do you do that?" And I've gone, "No." Should we be doing that? I don't know. Like the only thing, in fact, this goes back to the lapette. The only thing that we really have, and obviously this is based on science, is if you're pregnant, you're not allowed to eat lapette because it's got such high levels of both caffeine and there's something called, I can't remember the name, it's like theobromine or something. There's some other thing in it, which means that your levels of whatever hormones will just go off the scale. And so it's really bad for developing fetuses.
Right. Okay.
So in the same way that you're not meant to drink coffee when you're pregnant, you know? So you're not meant to eat lapette while you're pregnant. I mean, the levels of this, the stimulant that they have is high enough that in the same way that, you know, you might use like caffeine tablets, Pro Plus, to stay awake. People eat lapette to stay awake. So like if you've got like students cramming for exams, they will eat lapette through the night to stay awake so they can keep studying.
Fantastic. Natural. Let's say natural way of staying awake. In terms of condiments and things that you garnish the foods and stuff, obviously you said fried garlic. Fried onions.
Fried garlics, fried onions, crispy things. We also like chili. But the way we eat chili, it depends on the dish you're eating. So it might be dry roasted. It might be crispy chili. It might be chili oil. It might be fresh chili or it might be pickled chili. And it's very specific. Like that, you know, if you see a dish and someone's put something else. So fresh chili isn't something we generally use apart from in salads. And so when I see people like serving up noodle dishes and they've sliced up fresh chili rings onto it, it makes my brain go a bit funny. I mean, it's fine, it's personal preference, but in my brain, I just feel like, but it goes so much better with chili oil or whatever, you know. So, but what we do is we kind of do that thing where we don't put it on the dish until you're at the table. We have it like at a carousel at the table, so people can basically add what they like when they like. So we're not kind of It's funny, we're very much in favour of people dressing their own dishes. So even in terms of, like, well, someone will, if you're in a restaurant or a stall, they'll, you know, give you a bowl of soup or a bowl of noodles, and then you'll try it, and they'll either let you adjust the flavours yourself, or they'll say to you, a cholo the la, angan lo the la, a salo the la, which means, does it need sweetness? Does it need saltiness? Does it need chili? And so you hand it back to them and you go, yeah, it needs a little bit more chili or something. And then they'll adjust it for you. Because, you know, you do have that thing where in the end people have their own tastes, right? You don't have this thing where a chef will serve something up and get upset if you add salt to it.
Given the proximity, I suppose, to Thailand, do you use fish sauce? Do you have fish sauce? Yes.
So we favour fish sauce over soy sauce, very much so. That is our. We probably use fish sauce more than we use salt, and we also use probably more important than in a lot of the country. Probably more important than fish sauce is something called ngabit, which is basically our equivalent of shrimp paste. And ngabit literally means pressed fish. So it's usually made more from like tiny fish rather than shrimps, although shrimps are often involved. And what this is because of the Irrawaddy, because we've got this huge bloody great river all the way through the country, this fish paste, this pressed fish paste is really important. And so everybody uses it apart from I think pretty much apart from the people in the Shan state, because the Shan state, you know, remember I said I'm a quarter Shan, they are in like the mountains, and so they're nowhere near the river, and so they tend to prefer to use fermented soybeans, and they use it like in a similar paste, and they call it bengabit. And bengabit just means bean ngabit.
Right.
So, well, I say they call it. The rest of the world calls it, the rest of Burma calls it bengabit, because for the rest of the country, it's like the bean version of ngabit. So it's still being described in reference to the fish paste. So yeah, this, and then that fish paste is often, especially for like poorer people, it's often the only thing they have to eat with their rice. You know, so it's very important.
And the flavouring and the saltiness and, you know, the whole umami, I suppose. Yeah.
Umami, definitely, because it's fermented.
Thanks for spending all this time explaining these things to me.
Oh, it's very nice to meet us, and it's very nice to be talking about something nice, because, as you said, things that are currently happening over Burma, it's kind of... I just want to talk about noodles. I just want to talk about rice and salads and fritters and things that make me happy.
Yeah, talk us about fritters then, because they are very important, aren't they?
Oh, okay. So important. There's a whole chapter in my book. And salads as well, to be fair. So the thing about Burmese cuisine, I guess, is that what you have at home tends to be rice. And everything else tends to be either an accompaniment or a street food snack or a snack generally. And so fritters, if you're going out for street food, there's just like fritter sellers everywhere. You'll just have people with their woks just in, they're either like separate little markets, night markets or day markets, or they're just kind of on the road by themselves. And they have a wok and they have whatever you fancy just frying away. And sometimes they're kind of like specific woks. So you have this type of fritter called molemia, which means couple crispy or couple snack. And what that is it's like these kind of very small little round pancakes that have been stuffed with spring onions and yellow peas and like sometimes a little bit of tomato and sometimes a whole quail egg. And what you do is they get the two, so the kind of, it's like a frying pan like drum with like these little concave indentations. So each little pancake is being cooked separately. So a bit like takoyaki and a bit like Phnom Krok, I think it's called. And so lots of other countries in that area have very similar pans. But I think, so what we do is that we then kind of scoop out these little pancakes and then we join them together while they're still hot. So they seal and then they form like this perfect crispy shell. And that's why they're called couple cakes or husband and wife cakes, because you're bringing two halves together. And those are really nice. But like anywhere you go, you'll see kind of like like our tofu, you know, our tofu, which isn't soybean based, it's chickpea or split pea based. So you'll see tofu fritters, or you'll see prawn fritters, or bean fritters, or sweet corn fritters, and you know,
brilliant.
It's just so common to just grab some in the same way that I guess here you used to like be able to grab a hot dog or, you know, some chestnuts off the street. Then in Burma, you're just grabbing fried things off the street.
Yeah.
And it's always made to order. So sometimes you have to wait a little bit, but that's how you ensure that it's absolutely fresh and absolutely crispy and hot. And yeah, it
sounds like a great street food for here as well, if and when they're... You know, food markets open.
For sure. I mean, the only thing is I worry about health and safety because, like I said, these are massive woks of frying oil. So, I guess here you'd use deep fat fryers. I think that'd probably be a bit safer. Probably. All plugged probably in with maybe. Safety cut off, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we love fritters. And then, like I said, the other thing we love is salads. And salads are kind of treated in the same way. So it's funny because salads aren't like a dainty thing in Burma. When we say salad, we're actually talking about a combination of ingredients that have been tossed together with a dressing that often doesn't require any kind of leaf at all. Or even sometimes no vegetable at all. Or like the vegetable might just be some onion, you know? We have kind of very meaty salads and we have very fishy salads. And like we have the lepeto, so the tea leaf salad that I mentioned. And then we have a salad which is primarily based around lemons, which where the main ingredients are basically lemons, fish sauce, chili, and ngabit, the shrimp paste I mentioned. And you know, these aren't things that you lose weight on. These aren't things that and because of that, they're considered snacks. You will have salad vendors again on the street making your salad to order.
Oh, wow.
And like I said before, they will adjust to your taste. So you'll say, "Oh, can I have can I have like that fish salad, but can you put a little less chili in it or a little bit more vinegar, that kind of thing?" And so people will just walk around like snacking on salads and they'll walk around snacking on fritters. And this is how, you know, we snack and we're happy. And it's because of that, because it's not dainty, it's also not like associated with either women or men. You know, everyone will eat it. Children will eat it. So.
That lemon salad sounds very intriguing. How is it made?
So basically you you peel a lemon and you get rid of all the white pith and then you slice it very, very thinly. So you've basically only just got like the lemon pulp left, the kind of like the kind of, I don't know what they call, do you know what I mean? Like the kind of then you've got the pulp and you put it in the plate and then you kind of marinate it slightly with fish sauce, with various other kind of ingredients, all kind of like spicy bits of garlic, bits of oil. And then you kind of leave it to soak in those flavors and textures. And then you kind of slice some shallots very, very thinly and then you throw it into the mix and then you mix it all up.
Sounds great.
Yeah. And then it's ready. And so you eat that with rice or you eat that with a soup on the side. And yeah, it's kind of, because it's lemons, obviously, when you eat it, it's kind of quite powerful at first. But then it mellows out to a really, really lovely kind of long, savoury, mellow aftertaste. So yeah, it's very addictive.
I bet.
But you know, like I was saying, because obviously rice is the kind of the daily meal that we eat at home and everything else tends to be stuff that we go out and eat for fun. Even noodles are kind of categorized in that same way. So like we'll often go out and eat noodles and then we'll go home and eat our actual dinner. So
basically, yes, it's... We eat and then we go to eat.
Yeah, because, you know, everything else. We have this generic category called monk. And monk kind of means snack and it kind of means like cake and it kind of means all sorts of things. But it's basically this mop-up category for stuff that we don't consider real food, which means that it's like bonus food.
I love Burmese food.
Yeah.
Well, like, food culture.
The same with desserts, because we don't have desserts at the end of the meal. We actually, going back to Lepet is how we end a meal. Sweet stuff we eat as a snack. So we'll go to a festival and we'll eat a snack, or we'll go shopping and we'll stop in a cafe and we'll eat some sweets and desserts. And
okay.
So yeah, it's just fun things to eat when we're not at home.
Yeah. Sounds good. As you said, you have that New Year festival suite.
With, yeah.
Any other like unique desserts or sweets that you would call?
So, I mean, we're not... I have to say, I've always been under the impression that we stole most of our desserts from either India or Malaysia because they're so similar to, like, archetypal desserts from those countries. So, like, we don't have a tradition of ovens. We have no oven culture. And so we only have one real cake, and it's called senumakin, and it's a stove cake, really. So you cook it in a pan on a stove, and then if you've got a grill, you might kind of finish it off on the grill, but you don't bake it. And it's basically based on something called suji ka halwa, which is like a semolina pudding from India. And it's pretty much the same thing. And then, like, another of our absolute favorite desserts is called falooda, which is a, you know, an Indian word. It's falooda. And it's like a rose pink dessert with ice cream and kind of vermicelli noodles and jelly and like basil seeds, and it's like a very ramped up milkshake. And it's amazing. But it's an Indian dessert, you know, and even the New Year dessert, it's so similar to a lot of the Malaysian desserts. There's one called Onde Onde, which is, to my mind, looks exactly the same. It's like this sticky rice ball with a sweetened side coated in coconut, although I don't think they do the thing with the chilies. So, yeah, I pretty much all of our desserts, I really do feel, are based on other people's. I think the only one I can think of that I would think is properly unique are the ones that are almost more savory than sweet. So there are a couple, like the thing that the tamanere, the pounded cake that we do, the one that we have competitions for. That is technically a dessert, but it's not. It's savory. But I find that to be a very Burmese thing, and I think it only vaguely qualifies as a dessert because it has coconut on it. and then there are various other pancakes which are kind of similar, and again they have like peanuts and sesame seeds and stuff, and I think just by mere dint of having those ingredients in it, it counts as a dessert. But the one I think, there's one dessert which I think is very Burmese, and I don't think I've seen it anywhere else, and I'm probably wrong, and it's probably comes from somewhere else. It's a dessert called mong le gao. And mong le gao literally means a bracelet snack. And what that is we get, it's sticky rice dough. So it's kind of similar to the other, we use a lot of sticky rice flour, basically. So you get sticky rice flour and rice flour, and you kind of mold it into a very pliable dough. And then you kind of roll it into a sausage, and then you turn the sausage into a donut. So you join it at the end. It looks like a bracelet, basically. And so that, and those are fried. So those are fried rice flour donuts, basically. And they're really tasty. They're very, like, very chewy rice donuts. And then when you serve it up, how you serve it up, so you serve it up with a jaggery sauce. So you could use, like, treacle or something, basically. So you serve up this kind of huge heap of rice flour donuts drizzled all over with this lovely kind of treacly sugary sauce.
Sounds good.
I think that's unique. That's the only one where I haven't seen something similar elsewhere. So...
Thank you. That's brilliant. Yeah, that's a very good dessert, actually. I mean, I suppose we can talk for hours if you want. We can kind of wrap up slowly here. Do you have other things to do, I suppose, on a Saturday? Yes.
I've got small children.
Okay. Yeah, great. Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you so much for talking to me and being a guest on The Delicious Legacy. And it's great to learn something about Burmese cuisine and your traditions and the way you eat, because it's kind of different. I mean, things that you said to me, like that you can actually season the stuff yourself, or you can adjust the seasoning by asking. I think the culture is different from European culture, that you have the chef, head chef, like, that's how I serve it to you, and you have to like it.
Yeah,
it's more polite your way.
I think the thing is that everyone's such a glutton. Everyone loves food so much that you kind of respect other people's opinions on it as well. So
more informal in a way, maybe. Yeah. But even so, probably more fun.
Very much so. But I mean, like, even in like fine dining restaurants over there, you still have that same carousel of condiments on the table. So people are still encouraged to adjust to their own preferences. So.
Brilliant. Excellent. Okay, on that note, let's say goodbye. Thank you.
Thank you. And everyone should buy my book.
Exactly. Exactly. Everyone should buy Mandalay. So, yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom.
Cheers. Have a good day and lovely weekend.
Okay, you too. All right, bye-bye. Bye.
I've been Thomas Dinas, and this is the Delicious Legacy Podcast. Have a lovely weekend. Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.